We're recessing the executive session and coming back into a public session of the Thursday, September 25th, 2008 Mesa City Council study session. We're going to try to group the remaining items on the agenda as far as subject matter. So we have items 3, 4, and 5 that all relate in one way or another to Mesa Proving Grounds. And then item 6, which is to hear a presentation and discuss and provide direction on the prepayment of certain bonds. We're going to go ahead and take item 6 first, and then we'll move on to the other items that all relate to the Mesa Proving Grounds. So, Mr. Raines.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. Thank you. Try to make this brief this morning and hope you won't ask too difficult of questions, because I did tell Larry Given to be here about 9:30, who's our financial advisor. But I think we can work our way through this one. To kind of bring everybody up to speed, the city has what we call the Municipal Development Corporation. It's an entity, nonprofit entity of citizens that we've used over the years to acquire specific assets. The majority, or the main ones of those, being our Pinell County Water Farms, the Mesa City Plaza Building, some downtown parking garages in the Cubs spring training facility. All of the debt that we had acquired through our MDC over the years has been paid off, with the exception of the debt we have remaining on the spring training facility. That debt is variable rate debt. It's an interest rate that floats with the market. It is due to expire in 2016 at the same time that our agreement with the Cubs is due to expire. And we had been approached by members of the MDC to try to look at fixing that debt to a rate-specific debt. And as in doing that, we looked at the best way to do that and maximize the savings for the city, and determined that an inter-fund loan within the city was probably our best way to do that. What we are proposing doing is utilizing our significant fund balances in our enterprise fund and paying off the last remaining piece of our Municipal Development Corporation debt, and then utilizing, over time, our general fund will reimburse our enterprise fund for the principal as well as the interest on a periodic basis during the time that the debt is still outstanding. This way, the enterprise fund is held harmless. The debt is removed from our books. The city becomes the final owner of the Hohokam Stadium rather than the city's MDC board, and we can move forward as well as save some money over either fixing the debt to a rate certain instrument or allowing it to continue as a variable rate instrument.
Mayor and Council, really the opportunity to do this is, one, the amount, I believe, Mr. Raines, is $9.9 million. And we, because of the way we've been able to develop the fund balances in the enterprise fund, this would allow us to do an intergovernmental, I guess, loan, if you would. And that way, the enterprise fund would then accrue the interest. They would receive the interest that we would otherwise have to pay to someone outside the city. So we think this actually benefits the city in the long term, and it gets this debt taken care of. It gets it off the books for the spring training enterprise that we track. So this is what we'd like to propose to council to do that, to take that action going forward.
Can I put this in layman's terms so I can understand it?
Sure, Mayor.
You know, I understand that within our accounting and within how we look at things, we have different funds. We have the enterprise funds. Some of those are legally separated by either statute or by things, initiative, or however we've done it. Other things are separated within our books and how we do business. I think to the general public, there's a big pool there of city assets and that are available. And I, from what I'm hearing, within this pool, we have set aside reserves within the enterprise funds, which is, so people know, that's our operations, such as our water and our electrical and those things that we've established these reserves. We have the ability to utilize some of these reserves to extinguish debt that we are paying interest on, and in the current environment, as interest rates go up and things like that, you're proposing that we take some of these funds that have been set in reserve and established within from the enterprise or utility, for lack of a better term, operations, to pay off that debt, and therefore we will restore that reserve as funds come available from our other funds, so that reserve will be made whole. But instead of paying some outside party, we're going to extinguish this debt, lower the debt obligation of the city as it relates to the spring training complex, OHOCOM, and then not pay an outside party. Now, those reserves then in enterprise are lowered, but that's an amount you feel comfortable with, and you feel that it's worth lowering those reserves because we have sufficient remaining reserves in the enterprise that we can easily handle this from a financial standpoint and not raise our internal risk to a level that is not acceptable. Is that an accurate description on
Sam? Correct description, Mayor. And then, yes, I also agree that our fund balance is high enough in our utility fund that we believe firmly that the reduction of this 9.97 to pay off this debt does not in any way jeopardize that fund. We've raised it to a significant levels through actions over the past several years in order to put ourselves in positions to achieve savings such as this.
But what we're really doing as a city entity overall, we are trading the risk of paying outside bondholders, which we are liable to, for a reduction, an acceptable reduction in our reserve account.
Correct.
Our protection. Okay.
As well as not only not paying outside bondholders, but not paying annual fees.
Right.
And remarketing.
We're lowering
expenses
our costs.
Everywhere.
We're lowering our costs.
Correct.
Because those reserve amounts are held in, and they're, we're paying this outside interest when we have the wherewithal from those reserve accounts to extinguish this debt, save ourselves money, save ourselves fee. And the one risk we're taking is that we're lowering the reserve amount, but you feel comfortable that that's an acceptable risk?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Councilmember Richards.
Let's really boil this down to simple terms. How much is this saving the taxpayers of Mesa to do it this way?
I looked at it on one of two ways. We believe it'll save us at least $116,000 over our current structure of variable rate debt, avoiding these annual fees of remarketing expenses and things of that nature for this variable rate debt. Or it could save us up to, if we were to have fixed the rate with a normal instrument and gone out into the market and sold bonds and things of that nature, that those savings in comparison to that would be well over $390,000.
So between
$116,000
and $390,000?
Through the life of the loan, sir, over the period.
Not
annual.
Okay.
Yeah.
Through the period of the debt.
So how much debt are we extinguishing?
We're extinguishing $9.9 million.
So $10 million that was due to be amortized or paid off lump sum?
Amortized over the next 8 years.
For another 8 years. And there's only $116,000 we would save by paying off debt 8 years early, a $10 million debt 8 years early?
If we were, and again, what we're going to do is continue to pay ourselves internal interest.
Well, I understand that. But the taxpayers, once again, I understand that we're having an inner fund, right. But as we understand this is one from a net savings. I right. Get it that the general fund is paying interest to the enterprise.
But there's a full savings of the full savings of interest costs that we would have borne over the remaining term of the 9.9 is estimated to be what?
Well, let's talk two levels. First of all, Brian's talked about the real savings.
We understand. Just okay. Tell us what the interest
now,
savings would be.
Now we're looking
9.9.
At the cash flow savings. I'm more interested in the cash flow. That's about $1.7 million to the general fund per year.
Thank you. That's what I think is important to us because, once again, I know that in government finance, we tend to think these things are, I hate to use the word silos, but that they're somehow. But these are city assets, and whether you pay one hand to another, I'm looking at it as we have an opportunity cost. We could take those reserve funds and we're investing them, we're doing whatever with them, or we can continue to pay an outside party. I'd much rather save the interest. And to me, it's a city asset one way or another. I mean, we could sweep those reserve funds almost, the council could, not at will, but certainly we could sweep those in the general fund and utilize those otherwise. We've decided to leave those in reserve and to take a debt, extinguish it, thereby lowering the city's risk, and there's a real savings to the city.
There's a cash flow savings.
Cash flow savings. Okay, I got you.
So a real savings of up to $390,000 and a cash flow savings of $1.7 million a year. Am I hearing that right?
I've got the schedule. For this year, it's 1.7. Next year, it's 1.9. On average, it's about $1.2 million to $1.3 million, I'll
right.
just say.
Yeah. That's, as we look at it, that's the that's what we're
And that's thinking. The general fund.
See, that's general fund.
Well, what we're trying to do is we are, trying to save
money.
A cash flow perspective.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we are going to recognize that we will have to then make the utility fund whole as a payment. So, but instead of paying back paying the note back to some
outside
third party.
If they we're paying ourselves.
Existing, or we're paying ourselves back.
Yeah. Marvelous.
We're paying
Thank
ourselves.
You.
Okay.
I'd like Richards. To make a motion that we advise staff to go forward with this.
Second.
We have a motion from Councilmember Richens, a second from Councilmember Kavanaugh. Any other discussion or questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. No. Call Larry, tell him he can stay home. And we don't want to get billed for it either. That's another savings. Larry doesn't have to come. And that may match the annual interest. Okay, we'll now move on to item number three. Hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on master plans for the Mesa Proving Grounds. Ms. Huning.
Good morning.
Ms. Huning. I'm sorry. Beth.
Mayor, how are you this morning?
The floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm going to kind of brief you through the master plans that we've been studying for the last several months for the Mesa Proving Grounds. The site has five master plans: streets and transportation, stormwater, water, wastewater, all of which we would see in a normal site, and then also a fifth newer master plan for non-potable water for irrigating the various turf areas on site. So last week, Alan Sanderson, our city traffic engineer, covered streets and transportation, and I'm going to take everything having to do with water to the right of the streets. So. And before I get into the master plans, I'm going to talk a little bit about the relationship of some of the documents we have and how they govern the infrastructure as we proceed through this type of a project, this type of a planned community district. So first, we'll look at the framework. And the way the project has been set up is with the community plan that you've all received. It has sections that pertain to the infrastructure, and then there are the master reports, and the master reports are the umbrella that covers all of the infrastructure for the 3,200-acre site. And then along the way, we realize that over 3,200 acres, that things can change over time. So we've got a provision where we can use the development unit plans and subsequent site plans within the development unit plan to consider the densities as they fit into Exhibit 410 of the community plan. So what those do is they allow us to do some tweaking as we go through and make the infrastructure fit what is being developed. When we look at the community plan, there's actually five sections of the community plan that that talk about infrastructure. Four, real quickly, just summarizes, very brief summaries of the master reports and acknowledges what their role is. Five establishes what we want to see at the development unit stage with master plan updates and any changes that may need to occur to the infrastructure. Nine, this was interesting. When we originally envisioned PCDs, we thought, well, we'll do a whole set of engineering standards, bless you, specifically for the project itself. And when we got into the project and the uniqueness of the character, DMB came in with a proposal in the beginning, and I think what we all came to the conclusion is what we really need to see is what is being developed in the specific applications. So what we then did was come back with Section 9 of the community plan, which establishes the applicability of the city's engineering standards and provides flexibility in reviewing alternatives for sustainability or alternatives that would support the objectives of the community and still meet public health, safety, maintenance requirements. So it also establishes a procedure whereby we can look at those standards at each development stage. And then 10 and 13 specifically apply. 10, Alan covered last week, specifically applies to street cross sections. And 13, I'm going to talk a little bit more about when we get into the master plan itself, so you can see some of the differences in the character of what we would do in the stormwater system. I'm just going to dive right in now to the master reports and talk a little bit about the infrastructure and the demands and some of the things we're looking at right now. And I start with stormwater. We look at two things when we look at stormwater. One is off-site flows and one is on-site flows. When a development comes in, they are obligated to take all of the stormwater that hits their site from someplace else, convey it through the site, and manage it back to its historic outfall. And I put this aerial photo, and you can see to the east of Signal Butte on the right side of my screen, all the washes that are coming in from the east and then across the north. The siphon draw is a fairly major wash that comes in and hits the site. When GM Proving Grounds began working with this site, they developed berms along, or basically hills, and ways that diverted the water elsewhere off the site, along Elliott and then south along Signal Butte. So all of those washes you see were then diverted down Elliott and Signal Butte. And at times, Elliott would become a river. And then the site itself was required to retain the 75% of the 100-year 24-hour storm, which is a sizable storm. But when this happened, flood control and the city got together and said, well, we don't want Elliott to be a river. So we developed the East Mesa Area Drainage Master Plan, which was adopted by the city in 98 with the flood control district. And then we began to build a series of projects where we participated financially with them in the projects for regional flood control. You see on the north side of Elliott at the top of the red screen there, those are the Elliott basins, and they intercept the flow from the siphon draw wash to the east and then channel it down through a series of pipes. And then when the freeway was built, a regional drainage system was built along the freeway. Mayor?
I'm sorry.
I just don't know.
I know.
Siphon draw.
Clear to the right of your screen in the top. The siphon draw wash is what that is. It's a major existing natural wash.
That's the name of the wash.
Yes.
It looked like a technical term.
Okay, that's what I thought
it's not
was.
The name of the wash.
I thought maybe you were siphoning stuff.
Somebody named it that a long time ago. I don't know.
I was thinking the same thing you were.
It's a wash. It's a natural wash.
Okay.
Sorry. And it essentially what happens there is a few years ago, we built a project in conjunction with the flood control department. They provide funding, and I believe we provided 35% of the funding for it. And then those basins kind of level the flow out, and it enters some piping along Elliott, and then it goes down and into the freeway drainage system. On the east side, everything went south and into, you can see about along the line of the Ray Road site there, the alignment is the power line floodway. A lot of the flow then went on into the floodway and went west to the regional drainage system. And that's how the off-site flows are being managed today. Of course, when the site develops, the berms are going to come down. And the engineer for the project, Wood Patel, has spent quite a bit of time at flood control running a substantial number of computer models. And flood control has sent us a letter essentially saying that they will allow the water from Elliott and Signal Butte to be channeled and continue into the regional flood control systems, that they're satisfied with the modeling and they've signed off with continuing to manage off-site flows through those regional facilities. Now, south of the power line floodway, those flows will be channeled south along Signal Butte to Williams Field and then discharged at, you can see kind of the existing natural washes in the site to the west there into the Pacific Proving Grounds and continue its historical path through there. So that's how off-site flows are going to be managed for the project. We looked then at on-site, and just to orient you, Elliott is kind of at the top of the screen, Signal Butte on the right, Ellsworth on the left, and this is a work in progress. We have been working quite a bit on the off-site flows to resolve those with flood control and working with the engineer and flood control. So I asked for an on-site retention plan, and they provided this to me the first of the week, and it's really, as engineers, sometimes we tend to look at the worst case. So what they've assumed in this model is that some of the upper development units aren't showing any on-site retention. Every site's required to retain the 100-year, 2-hour storm in Mesa. That's our standard. And what they're showing is those channeling down to the Great Park, kind of, which you can see the blue squares that kind of follow each other in an S pattern down the site from north, kind of northwest to southeast. And then some smaller decentralized basins in the lower zones. We're still having discussions with this and more discussions about getting some more retention in the upper development units instead of all of it going to the Great Park. So that's one of the things we still have on the table right now.
The question I have about this is that we're looking at a 3,200-acre on-site retention but the 3,200 acres is separated into several different villages,
right,
per se, which are going to develop over 30 years. And the question I have is that, you know, what do we do in the interim as this builds out on unit by unit? Are we going to retain in each unit? Are we going to do the whole master plan in the Great Park? It certainly at least mass grade it so that it serves as a retention basin. What are the thoughts on that?
Well, I can tell you kind of what we've discussed a little bit on the first development unit, which is 5, kind of in the top center where the Gaylord site is. There will be some retention built with the golf course for that site, but I believe they'll also be moving into some of the western development units and putting some temporary retention basins in as well until the Great Park gets built. So what you're going to see is probably some graded temporary basins in the other development units until the Great Park gets built and some of those areas get constructed.
Okay.
So that's pretty typical in development to see those temporary basins till the site develops as a whole. But we will be back to talk about this one some more. The DMB, and we get into talking about basins, has a different type of concept for this site. It's an urban concept and more of an urban fabric. We'd like to see some more smaller basins in those upper zones. And right now, this is 466 acre feet of water, which is a foot of water over 466 acres, essentially, in these retention basins. And about 46% of that is ending in the Great Park. So we do have some other discussions where we'd like to retain higher.
As we go forward, I'm a little bit concerned because, you know, I know historically we've done a dual use with our parks.
Yes.
And with our retention basins. As you go to smaller retention basins, you get a greater slope, and it really becomes a retention basin that maybe doubles as a park if somebody's willing to walk up and down a very sloped and deep crevasse almost, which means it looks great on an engineer's map. When you build it, it's not very appealing, and certainly not in an urban environment where you want a more street level, flat kind of a park. How do we intend to? The parks are the most important on a long term basis. Obviously, the retention is extremely important when you have a flood. How do we intend to mix those?
Mayor, I have some pictures I'm going to show you here in a little bit regarding the types of basins they'd like to develop. I've got some pictures of the ones we typically develop, the large central basins with the gentle slopes and the parks in those, as well as the decentralized smaller basins.
Yeah, but I'd like to make sure that I know that in basins we try to accommodate those two by making a certain percentage that stays high and dry, which creates right. almost an island, which once again you get out of the Ramada and you go down this incredible slope that people are going to break ankles on, and it's just not visually appealing, and it's really not very useful. So if some way we can either segregate those uses, and I know that makes it tough,
mm-hmm.
but I think we really need to look at making sure that we have parks that are parks, basins that are basins, and when the two mix, that there's a subtle and gentle difference where they can accomplish both things without creating the kind of stark difference that you see constantly around the city, where you look at it and you say, gee, that was a nice retention basin that they happen to stick a Ramada and they raise something 5 feet. Visually, it's not very appealing, which means people don't use it.
We agree. We have a lot more discussions to have as these development units come forward. I did want to talk a little bit about one of the bigger things that you will see in Section 13 of the community plan is the concept. Our engineering standards, and some of this is for maintenance reasons, some of it's for also kind of putting together enough acreage to have a sizable park. You can see these types of retention basins around the city at different HOAs and in different developments where they've got a combination park retention basin facility. What they would be asking for here is something more along these lines. They're looking at a more urban and a denser environment where they would attempt to, you know, where they'd be looking to putting these smaller kind of green spaces, places where people could go and be that weren't all completely urban and still provide some cooling areas. We did meet this week with a landscape architect, and she has some unique ideas. If you've been out to ASU Polytech and looked at some of their site out there with some of their retention basins, she was the architect for ASU Polytech. And it's a pretty unique site in some of the things they're doing there. And they are looking at some very unique things, trying to find ways to use water differently in terms of maybe collecting condensate from building and stormwater and using those to create features in these small areas.
Councilmember Summers had a question on this picture. Look, there's these big grates in the middle, and I don't know whether those are dry wells, which I know that in Mesa we don't really like dry wells, but I would assume that in these urban areas, are you considering that as a use, or are these all going to be piped to a larger retention?
We're looking at a variety of uses. There may be some underground storage, there may be some some retention and some dry wells in these areas. One of the things we've indicated is that when we go to these decentralized basins, and one of the reasons we do the larger centralized basins with parks is for maintenance for our staff, these will be privately owned and operated. So we'll be looking at some alternatives like the dry wells and the underground storage. They've also proposed some sustainable techniques yet that we have not yet gotten into, rain gardens, bioswales, some things that are more unique in character that we may see in here.
The one thing that, I mean, as we go through, I'm glad that you're looking at a variety of things. I know one of the challenges is as we go forward and we don't allow those different kinds of solutions, you're going to have these, which are nice, these little urban gardens, but they're also low, which means you're going to have to have a sump, which is going to pump it up to some, which creates constant maintenance problems. Whether it's an HOA or us, we end up getting involved on a long-term basis, especially if there's a sump that's not functioning. We're the ones who get the first calls and get involved, because then you get into a pooling of water, get mosquitoes, the whole bit. So I'm glad to hear that you're looking at a variety of solutions.
Yeah, Mayor,
Councilmember Higgins.
I just wondered, what is the history with dry wells that you said we don't like them? Are there things like mosquito issues or...
Yeah, I really think it's a drainage, just and maintenance. They have to be maintained very frequently, and I think that's probably the bigger issue. Is that if they don't drain, we still have to meet a 36-hour drain time in Maricopa County due to nuisance conditions like mosquitoes and other things. So, it's been a challenge for some of those. So
yeah, one of the issues is if you have put in dry wells, and let's say they don't percolate and they don't drain, then what do you do? That's been one of the big issues.
So we look at that very carefully on every development as we go, but we will be looking at some other things here. The landscape architect earlier this week proposed some very unique opportunities to use some of that water to create green spaces, so we'll be looking at that as we go along. And then I'm going to get into potable water, kind of moving around the hydrologic cycle here, I guess, a little bit. The site, this is our water zone map. The city is broken into pressure zones of about 100 feet, and they are, what makes it easier for us is that the site, even though it's 3,200 acres, is wholly located within one zone in the city, so we aren't crossing zone and mixing facilities. This is from the water master plan. And I'll kind of walk you through it. Up at the northeast corner is the city's new water treatment plant that's going in at Signal Butte and Elliott. The first phase is under construction, the reservoir and the boosters. And we started design on about a 3-mile long line and turn out to the CAP canal directly east on Elliott. So the water to the site will primarily be fed from this area. We've master planned the water plant for 30 million gallons a day, although the site could take us all the way to 48 million gallons per day if we need to. Their engineers run the models, and we're concurring with the flow rates, and I'll show you a little bit how they relate to Exhibit 410 and the lugs based on your questions last week. The primary infrastructure then you see is the water plant at the northeast. There are times when the water plant is out of service or we can't get CAP water due to drought or some other reason. We use groundwater wells as backup supply for those times. So the little triangles you see are groundwater wells. Those north of Elliott and east of Signal Butte, we already have in process, and we're building and drilling and equipping as we speak. We are asking the developer to work with us on four sites within their development for additional wells. And then in terms of the larger infrastructure, I'll cover to the south, you see something called the Desert Wells Groundwater Facility. We will have some reservoirs in that location as well. So when the CAP plant is down, the site will most likely be fed from the south out of those reservoirs and a groundwater facility that we will have down there, as well as the wells distributed throughout the site. So the water kind of does this, in essence. You know, it comes from both directions, the south and the north. So what you see in terms of larger and major infrastructure is the 30-inch line down Signal Butte, and then you see one coming up from the south, a 24-inch line, and those all meet in the middle along sort of the Werner Road angled alignment through the site, and the Chrisman alignment angled through the site, and a 24-inch line. And from there, everything else is smaller, 16s and 12s to distribute around the site. Now, what the engineers projected right now is about 5 million gallons a day average flow at build-out based on the maximum densities in 410. So, in other words, the 20 million square feet and the 15,000 residential units we've been talking about. And then our peak day summer demand is about 9.2 million gallons per day. You see our water plant is master plan for 30, so you're looking at about a third of the flow.
Beth, you said it real fast. Say it slowly again. What does this master plan anticipate as far as growth, development?
I'll show you here in 1 second. There's the table. And I didn't put this in to strain your eyes or to give you a pop quiz on when we're done. The way we size these facilities is on exhibit. These have been sized based on exhibit 410. 15,000 residential units, 20 million square foot of the non-residential, broken down over each development unit. Now, the reality is not every one of the 15,000 units turns on their water or flushes their toilet at the same time. So we convert that density to gallons per day per acre. So we use flow factors that relate to the densities, and that's what that table does, and it converts it down to roughly the 5 million gallons a day that will be projected for the site. So that's how the two relate, just so you know. And we are programming in the master reports for that level.
These ratios changed significantly. Let me just play it. If we doubled the residential versus the commercial, what effect does that have on your water demand?
It will change the flow factors.
Higher, lower?
I'd have to look at it.
Okay, but it could change.
And it depends on the density of all those uses as well. You know, if you got suburbia, that's a lot lower flow rate than if you have a very dense urban residential core. So.
Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you. I just said, is this for the whole GM Proving Grounds area, including the Pacific Proving?
No. This is only for the Mesa Proving Grounds, which is the DMB site.
With all your big lines that you have in there, I can tell all the... Are you counting those homes in these numbers? Because, like, these big lines that are coming into across that site, into that site?
The line down Signal Butte will also be serving to the south as well. And so what we do when we develop the master plan, when the water department develops the master plan, is they'll update it with these numbers. But their master plan is based on the Mesa 2025 general plan, which projects densities in those areas for Levine's site, for the Pacific Proving Grounds, and other things. But as of yet, they haven't come in with their site plans to tell us what they're proposing in those areas. We are basing them on the current 2025 general plan, but we do include those in the calculations for offsite demands.
So those numbers are kind of included, but not...
They're considered in the sizing, yes.
Is it a big difference from the 2025 general plan into what they've got now? I mean, what they're planning, I'm not sure.
Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, yes, there is an increase. It's been a few days now since I've looked at those comparative numbers, but job-wise, again, as you'll hear a little bit later in some of the other presentations, there's different ways to calculate the numbers that'll give you different things. But job-wise, they're looking in place from about a third more to twice as many, and housing-wise, it's someplace around about double, I think, at least, again, a third more of the housing units that they're projecting.
So Beth, the main lines that are coming down from the north and then the 24-inch coming up from the south, that's going to be adequate, too, for all the extra
yes,
houses?
Yes, we believe so, yes.
Okay, great. Thank
Based
you.
On what we know today.
Right.
So that...
I guess what we're saying is that we have the capacity to provide the water. I'm trusting that the water department, since they've done this so many times, they can figure out how to get it from here to there, maintain pressure and capacity.
Right. Okay. We need to be sure we have fire flow, and we need to be sure that we can meet demands, and those are
The first thing is we need to make sure that we have the water to begin with.
And I'm
trusting that you'll get it there in a way that will keep up with demand, keep ahead of the proposed use and do that. So.
I'm hoping Catherine's sitting behind me here.
To me, that's the biggest question.
She promised she'd come back me up.
I love the maps. I'm assuming that you will know how to get it from the source, whatever that source may be, to the end user in a way that provides adequate fire protection and provides adequate pressure. That's something you'll have to deal with. We want to make sure that we have plenty of water in our inventory to even service the area.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. Hi, Mayor. We do. And if you look at the difference between what we had planned for the 2025 plan, what those projections come in at, just for this particular development, there's potentially a 3,000-acre-foot difference. They're potentially going to need 3,000 more acre feet than what we had originally planned for in the 2025.
They meaning the entire proving grounds
or
just
the DMB? Grounds.
Okay, so that includes the DMB and the Pacific proving site or just the DMB
Yeah, the site? Mesa proving grounds.
Okay, the Mesa, yeah. The DMB site.
Yes, okay. Yes. I'm sorry. So potentially 3,000 acre feet. Now, to put that in perspective, that's, you know, past the year 2030. At that point, that's less than 1% of our total water portfolio. So in my mind, that's within the margin of error. It, you know, we're saying it might be as
unless
high as...
Unless you're living there and you can have, and you're in that
right.
margin of error.
Well, and we actually have, and fortunately we have plenty of supplies. If it turns out to be that they need 3,000 acre feet more, if it turns out that they need significantly more than that, we still have the supplies to meet that.
But that will be self-governing. Now, like you said, as we hit 2030, maximum use, worst case scenario, we'll see that coming forward, and that'll be a self-governing thing. It's not a scenario that you see we're going to build out and all of a sudden say we don't have water. We can foresee
Absolutely.
That. We can plan for that, and it will be self-limiting as far as how many people go in there and how many business by the availability of water, which we will know well in advance in most cases.
Yeah.
Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, that's true. And we do have enough water. What it will
right.
come down to is how much reclaimed water we'll have to generate and make beneficial use of, which is fairly expensive,
right.
but it's there. If we need it.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So we'll move into wastewater again. This is the site, and we included to the west of the site. The site really is served to the west through future sewers in Warner and Ray. And you can see the kind of the DU5 and the upper sections of the development unit will ultimately go into Warner, and the rest of the site will go into Ray. Initially, Ray is the only sewer that will be in place, so we've asked. The one thing we're still discussing right now with DMB is the interim plan to get the wastewater to Ray to be then conveyed down to the city's Greenfield Water Reclamation Facility. So you can kind of see all that on the site and the size of those lines. We do have some flows from the east, off-site flows that aren't part, that are coming through the development along Ray Road, and we've accounted for those in the analysis. So you can see the major lines will be the line in Ray and Warner, and then there's a line all the way in Ray to Signal Butte and then north up Ellsworth. So it's pretty basic layout. And it's very consistent with our citywide master plan, the way we're working now. Estimated flows on average are 4.7 million gallons per day and peak of 11.6 million gallons per day. And that's how we arrived at those and related those to the 15,000 residential units and the 20 million square feet.
Getting back to all this is going down in the greenfield. So if we do hit a situation down the road where we are struggling and we want to use some reclaimed type water, we would have to bring it back up from the greenfield site?
Actually, no. And Mayor, no, that's
or
not the case.
Bring it in from above, from upstream, and then sort of do a trade-off? How would that work?
Right. That'll play into the discussions we'll have about the non-potable master plan. But actually, what we will do is continue to send reclaimed water flows down to the Gila River community,
right.
but then receive CEP water in exchange,
okay.
which comes in through that line that Beth was talking about, just east of the site from the CEP canal. So that's how we'll make use of our reclaimed water.
Okay. As a trade-off, not as a use, an actual physical use.
Correct.
It'll be, we'll send it south, and as the Gila River water allotment comes through the CAP canal,
right.
we're changing our reclaimed water for their non-potable water to put into our system sort of as a trade-off or balance.
Right.
That's the agreement.
Exactly. And the key point there, and again, we'll talk about it a little bit in the non-potable water master plan, the key point there is that the CAP water that we receive in exchange for delivering effluent to the Gila community comes with the legal distinction of effluent, and that's important for the lakes and the turf facilities.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So with that segue, and we're going to talk about non-potable water. The mayor's getting a little ahead of me here.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
But We're actually going to show you two options on non-potable, and this isn't quite correct. It's showing the CAP line coming down Ironwood, and actually it's going to go straight east down Elliott to the CAP canal.
And I guess for everybody, so they can distinguish, we're talking potable versus non-potable. Is potable or potable?
Either way.
Potato or potato.
Yeah, either way you want to say it.
Drink treated water that you drink and not treated, untreated water. River water versus treated water.
Exactly.
Is that an accurate description so people understand the difference?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
That's
so
exactly correct.
Potable water is treated water that you can drink. Mm-hmm. Non-potable would be like river water, the CA canal water. Okay.
What the developer has proposed is, and has worked with Catherine on, is using our exchange water, the effluent that we've exchanged for CAP water with the Gila River Indian Community. We give them 5 gallons of effluent, and for every 5 gallons of effluent, they give us 4 gallons of CAP water. And so we would take that some of that allocation from our exchange water out of the CAP canal and then bring it across, and at the point where the water for treatment to the potable water system goes in, we'd separate that into a purple pipe system or a non-potable water system for irrigation. And the two big irrigation sources you can see on the map coming west along Elliott and then south is the golf course in the DU5, and then ultimately the Great Park kind of north to east, northwest to southeast across the site.
And just so people understand, without getting into any details, the reason why the Gila River Indian Community is willing to do that is that they're taking our effluent for irrigation.
Yes, absolutely.
Versus taking CAP water for irrigation. So as far as they're concerned, they actually come out a little bit ahead. Right. We have a way to get to send our effluent downstream. And as far as the community is concerned, they come out ahead because they're picking up that 1 gallon. And as far as watering cotton, they don't care.
Yeah,
it's one half dozen the other.
That's exactly right. They receive more water, and it's much less expensive for them than what they would otherwise
have gotten. We can't use the effluent for the purposes that we want to use it. So for us, the non-potable water is more valuable than trying to keep and reuse the effluent, because we can't use it for the same purpose we can use the non-potable for.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Just to give a little background as to why we're talking about these exchanges and things. And it's really an upstream-downstream kind of a situation. Since they're downstream from us, it's an easy way to ship our treated water down to them.
Yep.
Right.
Okay.
And what this allows us to do is actually put the irrigation water, use it as raw water instead of actually treating it and then piping it through our potable water system. So it allows us to kind of keep our potable water system a little smaller in terms of both treatment and piping.
Which saves us all sorts of money because, you know.
It's chemicals. It's
chemicals, the whole bit, the whole process.
Power.
Okay.
People. So, and what you see here is option one. Right now, the one outstanding issue we have is a regulatory issue in the use of this water, and Catherine is much more versed on it than I am, but my simple understanding of it is it's a legal matter involving how we're going to transport the water to the site, and it has to do with commingling CAP water molecules CAP water with our effluent water, and right now we're still waiting on a determination from them. And so it's caused us to show two options. Legally, we could do option two and actually build a second pipeline to parallel our raw CAP water line to do this. And so we've got a second option shown in the event we get a determination that we'd like to see different. But we're doing that for now to show it in the master plan. We prefer the one line option in.
Yeah, what's going on here is, of course, remember in water world we have physical water and then we have water on paper, and the two are often very different. What comes down this pipe, if you look at option one, what comes down this pipe is all physically CAP water. However, legally it's two different sources. And in general terms, the Department of Water Resources doesn't like for you to commingle those two different legal sources. Now, we're working with them because, clearly, option two, you're building redundant infrastructure. It costs more for everybody for really no good purpose, in our opinion, because you're just transporting the same physical type of water. So we're working with them to make sure that we can implement option number one. I'm cautiously optimistic that we will be able to, but cautiously.
Cautiously optimistic. That's good. So,
okay, so I get this straight. So up at the canal, we're going to have either two intakes for the same exact water or one intake.
We'll have two pipes or one pipe, yes.
Well, I know. You have two intakes, two pipes versus one intake, one pipe. And it really doesn't make any difference to actually get 5 or 6 or 8 miles, however long it is, to get to right before you get to the treatment plant.
Right.
And you're going to have a little gate that's going to take it one way and to be treated and another way to go straight to be used as non-potable water.
Right.
And because of some governmentese that we can't figure out the difference between those two.
Correct.
Or they can't. All right.
Okay. Correct. But again, I'm...
It makes absolutely no sense at all, which is why it makes common perfectly sense.
So we've... And they recognize that asking us to implement option two seems unreasonable. So again...
And that stopped them before? Okay.
We're going to talk about that.
Don't answer that. So, okay, I get it. All right.
So again, I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll be able to work out a deal. They may ask us for some type of letter agreement or even IGA that would cover some of their concerns.
Gotcha.
So I'm working towards making sure that such an agreement, whatever form it takes, does not put terms that are too onerous on us. But again, I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll be able to come to something that works.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Again, just to summarize the non-potable, it's really CAP water through our effluent exchange. We'll be delivering it through the CAP canal. We have asked that a backup well be installed on the site and on the upper end of the piping. There are times when the CAP is out of service or down, and we want to have a water supply that we can put in there so that we don't end up with a brown park or a brown golf course. Looking at the demands, and these are kind of instantaneous rates. If depending on how we deliver to the lakes, they'd like to have us deliver to the golf course lake on a 10-hour schedule when the CAP's up and running, and that would be about 3 million gallons a day at that rate. Over a 24-hour period, the instantaneous rate drops. And then winter day demands, of course, drop substantially to about 0.3 million gallons. So you see a wide variation of flows over the year as the seasons change. Their peak flows will tend to be an overseed time in October when they start to overseed the golf course. And let's talk real quick about where we are with the plans and what can happen as we go through the process yet. Some of the things that can potentially change the plans as we start into the development units and is just, in summary, the densities affect the flow projections and demands. Development order can change that. We may need to bring more infrastructure on sooner or less, depending. So we'll see a phasing order in the development unit master plans. And then we are talking about potentially in the future some additional non-potable uses. There's been discussions possibly about a second golf course. There's been discussions about, if they add or change turf, of course, the irrigation demands change. Gaylord is having discussions about possibly using the water within their resort. And then the floodway and the schools have yet to be determined for whether they'd be using non-potable or not, but they may. So there's more discussions to have as we continue through the development unit stages.
I'd like to make one point, and I think we need to be clear. Because what could get lost, it would be a lot of concern as to how we use or reuse water on this site, because sustainability is certainly one of the overreaching goals for this plan. And if you looked at it, you could say, wait a second, we're not watering our golf courses with effluent. We're not watering our Grand Park. But in a sense, we are.
We are.
And I think that needs to be made clear. Even though we're using non-potable water from the canal, by the fact that we are exchanging with the Indian community our effluent, it has the same effect as keeping that effluent on site and using it. It's just because physically and because water does run downstream, and we've worked out an agreement with the Gila River Indian community, it has the same effect as if we had kept that effluent on site to water golf courses and things like that. I mean, would that be accurate to state that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that our contribution of reclaimed water to the Gila River Indian community, we lose that 20% when we deliver water to them through the exchange, the 5-4 exchange. Benefited the whole state in the settlement of the Gila River claims.
Okay. So I just want, as people go through and they look at where pipes are hooked up and they don't get the difference between this paper water and other stuff, that we have been planned this, and one reason to create this non-potable situation is to make maximum use of the effluent for non-potable uses so we can preserve water and meet that sustainability goal. We're just doing it in a little different way because of the way water flows and because of the agreements we have.
That's right.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then where we are today with the master reports, the master water report is near final. We have some polishing to do on it, and then it'll be done. The wastewater, we're having some internal discussions on the interim service to Ray and at what point we want to see Warner be built. And we'll be finishing that one up. Non-potable, we're waiting on the DWR determination. And we also will be coming to you in October with a water use variance. We have a section of city code, section 452 and 453, which limits how you use water in lakes and on turf. And so we'll be asking for a variance for the non-potable system for this project. And then on Master Storm Runner, as I indicated earlier, we're talking about the park retention and retention within each development unit above the park and addressing comments on the on-site retention. So that's where we are today with the reports.
Mayor. Councilmember Higgins.
Are there plans for DMB to use the non-potable water system in just the basic subdivision usage, like the green? I'm sure they're going to have lots of neighborhoods where the neighborhood controls the front lawn or the common areas. I just wondered if that system was planning to go out throughout the whole neighborhood rather than just like the big golf course or big green areas.
Councilmember Higgins, not at this time, though DMB has asked us to be open-minded about the possibility of that in the future. And of course, we will be, and we're happy to continue to talk about that.
Now, Mayor and Councilmember Higgins, we intend on creating a separate or a distinctive utility for the non-potable water system. So we want it to be, if you would, kind of its own enterprise. So when we'll have to look at this as how do we set this up and what will those costs be to extend the lines of a non-potable water system. And so that could be a possibility, but the ability to do that for individual homeowners may be somewhat expensive. But what we're right now we're targeting the larger open spaces that are water intensive, the golf courses, the large parks. But we also hope that maybe down the road, outside of even the Mesa Proving Grounds, there may be other property owners or developments in the area that we could extend this to and extend this utility of this enterprise to recover the operation costs through fees, just like we do with the other utilities.
Okay. Councilman Richens?
Chris, would that be similar in concept to some of the irrigated lots that we have in Northwest Mesa now? Is that, I mean, we use the term non-potable water, but a lot of us know our lots are irrigated from canal water, mm-hmm. and it's non-potable, but we just know it as irrigation. Is that the same concept?
Yeah, I think that's the way we would look at it, though. I think more as a, the only distinction I'm going to make is we don't today have a separate business plan or just irrigation system that we control as a city. Okay, it's all part of the water distribution business center. We are actually going to set up a separate enterprise for the non-potable water system, and where it can make sense to deliver that in an economical way that can be recovered by fees over time, that's how we would look at this. And so there may be that opportunity. Again, it's going to come down to the cost of extending the infrastructure to deliver the non-potable water to the areas that need it.
And if I could add, Councilmember Richens, another big difference is that the townsite irrigation, for example, comes through the SRP canals. You know, they're 100 years old. They've been there forever. And it's mainly gravity feed. Those are not really our systems. If we were to extend a non-potable system over here, it would need to be pressurized, it would need to flow underground, it would be significantly different, and the cost would be significantly different, and I think that's what Chris is trying to explain.
Yeah, you're looking at right now, just so there's no confusion, you have flood irrigation that is historic, that has grown out of the fact that these were farms at one time when subdivided.
Individual properties,
versus what we're creating is a pressurized, enclosed system that will basically go through an irrigation system, a pressurized type irrigation system, and not flood irrigation where you have that. It's much different. So same basic concept of non-potable canal water used to irrigate grass and shrubs and things like that, but the delivery system is completely different, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Next item is item number 4, here presentation, discuss and provide direction on economic development issues. associated with Mesa Proving Grounds, Mr. Gamage and Mr. Rigby and whoever else we have. And the group.
Good morning, Council, Mayor. Appreciate this opportunity. I'm going to kick it off, and I'm going to turn it over to these distinguished fellows to my right. You have Grady Gamage to the right and Alan McGuire, who have been brought on to discuss this key aspect of jobs. Just a 30-second thing is DMB has been working with the city and the Mesa Gateway Strategic Plan from their very start, and they are entirely involved with that process, and they agree with the process of the need to seek after the high-wage, high-value jobs. And key aspects like the Gaylord Project and others are a key aspect of that. So with that, we'll turn it over to them.
Let me start. Mayor, members of the council, this is a follow-up to the conversation we began at the end of the public hearing on Monday night. You will recall I talked a little bit about the comparison in job projections between the existing general plan and our general plan amendment, which you approved on Monday night. This is a more detailed look at the economic impact and job-generating impact of the Mesa Proving Grounds proposal that's embedded in that general plan amendment and in our PCD zoning. We've had two economic firms working on this. One is Elliot D. Pollock and Company. You all know Elliot Pollock. He was on the radio this morning, sounding fairly bleak, frankly, but nevertheless, you've heard his name before. Alan McGuire is the one who is here. I am hesitant in this week in American life to introduce to you an economist, a former state regulator, and a former investment banker, given that all of those professions are somewhat questionable these days. But he's a really good guy. Alan has done a lot of economic analyses that you have seen before, including one I think you're probably all familiar with about the impact of Arizona's military bases on our economy. He's had his own consulting business for what, more than a decade at least, and prior to that was in the state treasurer's office and in the investment banking business. He's been one of the key drivers of doing this analysis, so he's going to do a brief presentation, and then we're glad to answer questions.
Good morning, Mayor Smith, members of the council, Manager Brady, members of the city staff. My name is Alan McGuire, as Grady just said. This morning I'd like to do really three things. I'd like to do a little bit of a conversation about econometric modeling. I'm sure it'll be very exciting for all of you. But it will give you some foundation for the numbers that come later. I'll then talk about the results of that analysis and ultimately what they mean for Mesa. I presume that my time is up when the light turns red or a quorum of the council falls asleep. So with that, I want to repeat what Gray just said. DMB retained my firm and also Elliot Pollock's firm to work on this project. Elliot Pollock's firm did the fiscal and economic impact analysis that I'm going to present today and some of the stuff at the end as well. So a little bit about the fundamentals of economic impact analysis and fiscal impact analysis, which is what you care about. What does this mean to the city? Ultimately, you have to put all this in a little bit of context. And you have to start, because I'm an economist, you have to start with the economy. So what is it that makes the economy tick? What drives business? What drives impacts? Why do we talk about these multipliers, and ultimately, what does that mean for the city? This is a great little diagram. It shows you, I think, the classic old line, if you build it, they will come. But in this case, it's two different things. The top circle up there, the oval, talks about base industries. These are export industries. These are industries that bring money from someplace else into your community. Obviously, example is a manufacturing facility. They build things here. They ship them someplace else. People buy them and send their money back. Another good example, particularly in Arizona, is tourism. They come, as we say, the snowbirds come every winter, and they leave their money behind and go home, and we're really happy to see them go home. But we benefit from them because both a manufacturing example and a tourism example, they bring their money in. They are, in fact, base industries, importing money, exporting services or goods, in effect, and they build the local market. If you have a manufacturing facility, you will have retail and construction and service industries that grow up around that. So the key is, you try to build the base industries, and the local market industries will follow all by themselves. Why? Well, because the goal here is higher wages, higher productivity, higher multipliers, and I'll talk a little bit about what multipliers are in just a second, but the idea is to capture and retain more economic activity in your community, and ultimately, as a governmental entity, you care about capturing and retaining more of the fiscal impact, the taxes paid within your community. So multipliers. I'm an economist, a recovering investment banker. Multipliers have kind of a bad name, but they're very, very important, particularly for governmental analysis. They are important for private sector analysis, but more important, quite frankly, for governmental analysis. And how does it work? You take a bunch of inputs, you stick them in a computer, and a bunch of outputs come out. And the thing that takes them from the inputs to the outputs are these multipliers. Because you know when you go to the store and you buy something, that store got that something from somewhere else. And you want to think about how do you capture the second sale and the third sale and the fourth sale. And quite obviously, multipliers are very different. The multiplier in Springerville is much smaller than the multiplier in Mesa. Because most of what you buy in Springerville, the next sale is not in Springerville. It's some larger metropolitan area. But you buy something in Mesa, there's a very good likelihood that the next sale behind that happens in Mesa. It certainly happens in Maricopa County and certainly within the state of Arizona, unless you're buying something relatively esoteric. So they help us capture that full impact. We look at multipliers based on employment, based on wages, based on productivity, based on spending patterns. How long does it stay in your community before it ships out of state, et cetera. And we look at them three different ways, directly, indirectly, and induced. And these are really different impacts in the economy, and you care about them, quite frankly, quite differently. Now, let me give you a couple examples, and I'll try to cut some of the jargon a little bit. But in simple terms, direct is permanent jobs. This is the 100 people that work for the manufacturing company. They build widgets. Okay, that's your direct jobs and your direct impact. Indirect are the suppliers to that company. They're the 10 people that work for a machine shop that provide an input to that manufacturer who's going to sell that good out of state. And it also includes everything from janitors to landscapers to tax accountants to lawyers to everybody else. Those are indirect. And the third category, this is quite frankly the most important for governments, is induced. Because this is the jobs that are created by the spending of the employees. So you've got those 100 employees that work for the manufacturer. They earn income, they spend that in local stores, and they pay sales tax when they spend those monies, and they pay income tax on the earnings that they have as an employee of that manufacturer. The same is true for the 10 guys at the machine shop. They spend money in your economy, they pay sales tax, they earn income, and they pay income taxes. So much of the impact that you receive as a government comes through these induced spending activities of the employees. So to summarize that, direct is about the employer, induced is about the employees, and employees are what we count. Now this analysis and the analysis that I do generally is predicated on a model called IMPLAN. IMPLAN was developed by, if I recall right, 6 economists at the University of Minnesota. It's been around, I don't know, 20 years maybe. It's probably the most widely used reputable econometric model in the country. The other big name is the one you see that's done by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the federal agency. The results that come out of them are about the same. The difference is that the University of Minnesota guys have spun off into a private company. They update their multipliers every single year. They are dramatically different today for Arizona than they were 20 years ago for Arizona, and there's a simple reason why. Arizona's economy is much larger and more diverse, so that spending continues more times in Arizona before it travels out of state. So we get more and more of that benefit over time. So enough about that, except to say, understand that you have inputs that go through a model. That model generates economic outputs, jobs and wages and employment and things like that. That output then drives fiscal analysis. And the fiscal analysis is what turns into sales tax numbers for you, income tax numbers for the state. We divide the analysis into two phases, one-time construction, because they're so different, one-time construction and ongoing operations. You care about both of those, but for different reasons, obviously. Construction is the value of the construction converted into jobs. We convert the jobs into economic output, and we get a result. The multipliers, as I mentioned, capture how many times does that spending pattern recycle in the economy before it moves out of state. If you're buying gravel, you know how many times that recycles in Arizona because the gravel pits are just down the road. If you're buying some esoteric piece of equipment that's manufactured only in Switzerland, it doesn't cycle through Arizona very many times before it goes outside of the state of Arizona or outside of Mesa in this case. The thing that's important about this project, which is different than most other construction projects, is this is a massive project. You just heard about it in terms of the water utilization and the size. You've heard about that for months. What does that mean? It means this is going to go on for a long time. you do an economic impact analysis and a fiscal impact analysis for the construction of a new facility. The construction period is 1 year, maybe 3 years, very short term. This is an extremely long-term build-out period. So these construction revenues will come into the city of Mesa over a long period of time, quite frankly, decades. And then we also look at the fiscal impact. So all these jobs, all this spending generate money for the city. We look at two kinds of revenues, primary revenues, those directly received by the city, construction sales tax, for example, use tax on equipment that you have a use tax that you levy. We also look at secondary revenues. These are one step removed. Somebody else collects them, and then you get a share of them. You receive state shared income taxes and state shared sales taxes. These are part of the secondary revenues as well as the other sources that are listed there. Ongoing operations, change thought now. We're going from the one-time stuff to the permanent jobs. These are jobs that are going to be there forever, and they're going to be economic activity that's going to be there forever, and they're ultimately going to be fiscal impacts and revenues that will be there forever. We do the same analysis. We look at the same direct, indirect, and induced. Same kind of primary revenues, sales taxes, lease taxes. Again, these are annual revenues now. Not one-time revenues just from construction, coming in year after year after year. Secondary revenues, employee spending sales tax, again, that induced impact, and state shared revenues, income and sales taxes, again, annual revenues. So before I go into this particular project, I want to just stop for a second and back up and talk about two things. The first thing is, why do you do this? Why would you bother to go through this exercise? I mean, this is a bunch of, you know, pointy-headed guys going in a room with a computer, spinning out a bunch of numbers, and they're supposed to mean something to you. Well, from my perspective, this kind of economic impact analysis and fiscal impact analysis is, in fact, sort of the fiscal analogy to planning. You do planning so that you have some reasonable expectation of the most likely long-term outcome of a proposed project. That's exactly the same thing we try to do when we do economic and fiscal impact. We try to figure out what the most likely outcome of this project is going to be. Now, one thing I know, I've been doing revenue forecasts and economic forecasts for a long time, multiple recessions, shall we say. And one thing I know when I put my numbers in the blue chip forecast every month is I know I will be wrong. Actually, I got the number right one time. I know that my number will be wrong. If I predict 7.8%, it ain't going to be 7.8%. It might be 7.5 or 8.0, but it ain't going to be 7.8. If we can get in the general area, it's a good thing. The lack of exact precision isn't as important as having a general sense of what this means to all of you. The second thing I want to talk about just briefly, and this is easy for me to do because I'm not talking about myself, there's a specific reason why I recommended and DMB retained Elliott Pollack's firm. The first reason is, what about the model itself? Implan is a solid model. I've looked at all the models out there. It is a solid model. Those sort of blue sky, smoke and mirrors kind of forecasts that you see out there that say, but for this project, Western civilization would end, those are now outcomes coming out of Implan. I can guarantee you that. They're coming from somebody else. So the input-output portion of the economic portion is solid. And quite frankly, when you get to the second half of the analysis, the fiscal analysis, quite frankly, can't find anybody better than Pollack Shop. I mean, I have 30 years of experience in state and local revenue work. Elliott's about the same. He has people on his staff, Jim Rounds and Rick Merritt and others, that have two decades of experience. The internal fiscal analyses, I've been through these multiple times with the firm. They are solid. They are solid, and you can rely upon them. And that's ultimately what you care about. Are you getting, is this a problem of garbage in, garbage out, and a lousy machine in the middle? No. You got good inputs. You got a good machine. You got good analysis coming out the back end. So I think you can, in fact, have confidence as elected officials and senior staff members in the output from these models and their projections. So what's the assumptions that drove this model? You know, no analysis is any better than the assumptions that drive it. You've seen some of these numbers before, I think, in the planning exercise. But to refresh you on them briefly, 14.5 million square feet of office space. That's a ton of office space. We'll talk about that in the end. 4,000 hotel rooms. 1.2 million square feet of retail, 15,000 residential units. You know, this is a 3,200-acre parcel and project, huge project. This is a big deal. So what is the impact? Well, here's some numbers that give you some sense of that. Here's the economic impact of the construction spread out over a long period of time. You can see on the bottom line there, It's 116,000 job years. Now, it's hard to think about that. I know that those numbers are perfectly clear to you, so let me read a couple of critical ones.
That was job years, not jobs all of them.
That's right. It's job years. And you have to talk about job years, which is sort of this odd concept.
Those sort of like dog years?
Yeah, they seem like they last.
We're talking years. Multipliers here. I want to make sure that.
Exactly. It's kind of the same thing, except that it doesn't bark. If you think about construction, okay, if you build an office building that takes 1,000 builders a year to build it, that's the same as 500 builders for 2 years, because construction is a function of quantity of inputs and time. Okay, so the best way to think about these is this isn't 116,000 jobs for the next 25 years. This depends on how fast you build it. The faster you build it, the more jobs there'll be, but for a shorter period of time. So when we talk about that in terms of job years, that's the concept. That doesn't apply when we talk about annual ongoing things, because this is a construction project.
Well, and I guess that's my big question. I think we get it that proving grounds will provide a lot of construction jobs. I mean, you're building things.
Right.
I think one of the criticisms of the Arizona economy is that it's based on building things. And I think our hope is that to be sustainable, you can't be construction-based. I think we're living that reality right now. When the growth stops, our economy goes in the tank. I think one of our visions of Mesa Proving Ground is that we reap the temporary benefit of the job years that come through construction. I think what we're looking for is really to get into the meat of what kind of shift in the economic dynamics for that ongoing, that recurring, that after the house is built, after the building is built, what does that create? I think that's what we're really most interested in, because we get it with the construction.
That's right. Like the next couple of slides.
Okay.
But you as a city do care about construction to the sense
that it
helps fund your one-time
costs.
We care about it, but what we want to break the cycle is using that as a base. I think we're paying the price for not only caring about it, but we relied upon it. And when we look at the sales tax revenues statewide, the truth of the matter is that our largest sales tax generators, and we are overly dependent upon this, are new homes and automobiles. Right. And because they're the big ticket items, and especially new homes. You know, when you're cashing a $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 check, if you're in the city, from each home that's built, when that home goes away, it's a huge dent. We've got to get away from that. As far as depending on the city, I would love it if growth created our reserves and created our excess that we have, so that when growth does slow down and we go through these cycles, we're not sitting like we are right now with the peaks and the valleys. I know you can't completely eliminate that, because that's part of our life, but we're hoping that Mesa Proving Grounds at least sends us in the right direction, where we get away from a completely construction-based or even a majority construction-based type of economic activity.
Mayor, that's exactly right. That's the concept of the base industries that drive the local industries.
And I might just note, when we've talked to you in the past about comparisons between the Mesa Proving Ground site job generation and the existing general plan, those have all been about permanent jobs. We haven't talked about construction jobs at all in the past conversations that we've had in the general plan context.
Right. We've taken those as just being a given.
Right.
Okay. Right.
Right. It is different, though, here, because it's spread for so long, which is a little bit different.
So... $9.3 billion in project costs. There's the economic impact. Again, the same numbers. What does that mean in terms of revenues, in terms of primary revenues? Over the life cycle of the construction cycle, $137.7 million worth of primary revenues, another $20 million worth of secondary revenues, a total revenue source to the city over time of about $160 million.
Alan, can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Are you discounting those values, or are you just giving us the aggregate number?
Those are all in current 2008 dollars.
Okay.
So this is all in current dollars. Obviously, over time, they'll inflate a bunch. Yeah. But that helps you at least think about them in terms of your current budget and things like that. Now, what about the economic impact of the operations? You can see there on the bottom line, total number of jobs is 92,000 jobs, 91,815. Direct jobs, 46,000. $4.5 billion in wages. Now, that's a number people can wrap their heads around, because we all get a paycheck. We understand what wages are. Wages is something we can spend in the grocery store next week. $4.5 billion worth of wages. The key here is these are ongoing activities. This is going to be a function of the build-out of the project and ongoing revenues, ongoing activity for, within the city of Mesa for the remainder of time over. We also did the same analysis, just briefly, to give you a sense of it, with no vacancy. Part of what we do when we do these models is we assume normal vacancy rates, we assume normal use rates, we assume normal leakages. There will be people in the estimate that work in Mesa but don't live in Mesa. There'll be people that live in Mesa that don't work in Mesa. We accommodate all those things. If we take the vacancy factor out of the space, the number jumps up from the 92,000 to 101,000. So the number gets a lot bigger, and you can see the 50,000 direct jobs there, $5 billion worth of wages. So we have adjusted the numbers down, again, because numbers that are most useful for elected officials and senior managers are, in fact, realistic numbers, not absolute, perfect, best-case scenario numbers. But this gives you a sense of the magnitude. Again, how much does that mean in terms of operations? Again, these are annual revenues to the city from operations, almost $25 million with the primary revenues, another $15 million from secondary revenues, just under $40 million in total of continuing operational revenues to the city of Mesa over time. Substantial input that helps defray the cost of this project and hopefully contributes to the bottom line of the city as a whole, which is, I think, very likely. So we did a little bit of additional analysis for you because some questions were raised and we thought it would help give you some context on this. I'll let Grady describe briefly the difference between these two numbers, and then I'll talk a little bit about what they mean.
Yeah, one of the questions that was raised at the end of one of the last sessions and that I briefly talked about in the context of the general plan amendment is, okay, 20 million square feet is an aspirational goal. What if we don't get that much? The 8.6 million is an arbitrary number that's picked as a sort of what if we don't get that much. It's not a minimum in terms of some kind of necessarily expected development minimum. It really is arbitrary. It comes from, if you remember back to the development units and how we can transfer jobs between development units, in doing that, we came up with a minimum number of square feet within each development unit for purposes of entitlement flexibility. That doesn't mean that would be the minimum that would develop in each unit. It just means if we start doing transfers, we will guarantee not to transfer that many square feet out of a unit. So it's not a meaningful number, except let's pick something to do a lesser analysis than the absolute aspirational goal of the 20 million square feet. So this was an attempt to come up with what those numbers would look like as a result of that. Is the next one the comparison to other
yes.
areas?
Yes.
Yeah, one other thing I thought it was worth doing is to talk a little bit about comparisons.
Grady, can we go back? Because we didn't get it. So what you're saying in this is this meaningless $8.6 million square foot number. If I'm reading that correctly, you're saying that under that scenario, you anticipate about 20,000 direct jobs.
Right.
Under the current general plan, you're saying there's a little over 17,000.
Yeah, and let me talk about that for a minute.
Can you compare that?
We're trying to do apples to apples comparison here. The dilemma, there are a couple of dilemmas with our trying to do job projections on your existing general plan. And your existing general plan is now the new general plan. You did approve it, so you know we've changed it already. But the dilemma is the existing general plan didn't have job number assignments for the Mesa Proving Ground site. It has, again, an aspirational goal for a jobs number for all of Mesa based on that general plan. If you remember, the existing general plan had that huge swath of industrial property on the northern two sections of the Proving Ground. So you got about 1,200 acres there of just pure industrial kind of uses. Industrial zoning is very hard to model jobs on because it can mean anything from a warehousing operation like the giant Walmart warehouse over on the west side of the valley, where there's one employee for maybe 1,500 or 2,000 square feet, very low employment density, to a Motorola plant where there's an employee for every 600-700 square feet, to, frankly, an industrial zoning, you can have offices in most, you know, old-style zoning schemes where you've got one employee for every 300 square feet. So what assumption do you make when you look at 1,200 acres of industrial? You got to choose something.
But if I'm deriving something, though, from this, what you're trying to say is that under the most conservative minimum attainment, if I don't know if that's an accurate description of this 8.6 million, but it's the low end of the spectrum, what I think you're trying to say is that that provides at least as many, if not more, than what the 2000, whatever it was, general plan would have provided. Is that what we were trying to get at?
Yes, that is what we're trying to say in this slide.
So to cut through all the stuff, what we're saying is that, listen, we just changed the general plan description to the more expansive one, the single category type one. And what you're saying is that by doing that change and implementing this plan, you anticipate that in a, I don't want to say a worst case scenario, but on a minimum scale, we're providing at least as many, if not more, than we did under the general plan that we just replaced. So therefore, we would assume that the upside is tremendous.
Right.
That's what you're asserting.
That's correct.
Okay.
And the jobs we're talking about are higher density jobs, probably higher wage jobs as
a result.
And
they're more definable.
Yes.
You can define them easier than you could under the general type of a loose category that we had before.
Yeah, by the time we get to the PCD zoning, which you haven't formally seen in a public hearing yet, you're going to see that our plans are much more evolved and refined than what we had to work with under the prior general plan. So we feel as though we have a much higher level of reliability of the probability of job creation under our plan than we had under the old.
Because even though you're giving more flexibility within the trade-off, and this is one thing we're hoping to accomplish, is that while we give you more flexibility on the baseline, there is more, it's more definitive as to how and where and what those jobs will be.
That's right.
Okay.
This was just to try to give you some comparisons. These are huge numbers we're talking about. And if you think about that 8.5 million square foot number for a minute, now these are office comparisons. So the 20 million square foot aspirational number in our plans, 14.5 of that is office. If you compare to office uses, downtown Phoenix right now as we sit there today has 11.5 million square feet of office. That's 100 years worth of development in downtown Phoenix. The Camelback Corridor, which is probably 35 years worth of development at this point, has 10.5 million square feet. Scottsdale Air Park is an interesting comparison. I can't tell you the exact geographic parameters of that. This is a definition that's used by either Grubb and Ellis or Coldwell Banker, I don't remember, and they keep moving it. But that 9.5 million, Scottsdale Air Park began in the 70s, but it didn't really explode until about 15 years ago. So that's happened. Most of that has happened in about 15 years.
So let's talk about what this means in terms of the city of Mesa and its sort of economic structure. We looked at a couple things. We looked at the 20 million square foot commercial analysis. That's the 50,000 jobs we talked about earlier in the economic impact. If you assume you've got 15,000 residential units and you assume that 2.5 people live in each residential unit, you've got 37,000 residents. You take the total number of jobs divided by the residents. You get 1.35 jobs per capita, 3 1/3 jobs per household. Pretty impressive numbers, particularly in Maricopa County. Maricopa County, on average, is about 0.5 job per capita. Substantially different than 1.35 per capita. Huge difference. And about the most productive city in terms of jobs per capita is Tempe. There are about 0.8 jobs per capita. Taking the second analysis, this sort of arbitrary $8.6 million, do the same analysis, you end up with that, the numbers you see there, 0.8 jobs per capita, just under 2 jobs per household. Again, 0.8 jobs per capita, that's about as high as the most productive city, if you will, in terms of jobs per capita.
So why would we be, why would we be different? You're talking about if Tempe's the highest, why are we shooting? Why do we think we can do better than that here?
Well, bear in mind, this chart is on Mesa Proving Grounds only. This is not a citywide chart. It's not even an area-wide chart for around all of the Williams Gateway planning area. The reason we think we can be better is exactly what we've been talking to you about as we go through this. We see the Proving Ground as this center of regional distinction that has, at a minimum, two major sort of urban core job-centered areas, the one at Ellsworth and Elliott and the one down closer to the airport. As a result of that, there's more of the area of the site that is dedicated to employment and urban intensity as a percentage of the whole 3,000-acre site than you would have in a city as a whole, even like Tempe. I mean, Tempe is 55 square miles. We're talking here about 6 and a half square miles. So it's a function of the fact that this is looking at a snapshot around an intense urban area.
Let me ask you something.
So that's why the proving grounds is going to look a lot better.
How much benefit do we get from the fact that we're starting with really raw ground right now, and we can define where those are and develop around those versus every other area you had, although they're planned, they still grew organically. They started out as something, grew into it, and then were planned as they went along. What kind of effect do you think that has?
Actually, I think that has a huge effect. I have a whole other PowerPoint on that if you really wanted to see it, but let's not do it today. But
Thank you.
It's one of the things we're trying to do here that I think is really exciting and unusual is to figure out how now, when that land is sitting there essentially undeveloped, except for the old industrial uses that are out there, how will it over time transition to this level of high intensity? And one of the things that I'm going to show you in later presentations is how we're going to try to analyze and predict, as each site develops, how that site can subsequently redevelop in another generation at a more intense level.
That other areas did not have the luxury of being able to do.
Nobody's had the luxury of doing that, that I'm aware of.
I guess that's what I'm getting.
And that's the redevelopment conundrum, is you wind up trapped with a generation of development. When it's time to go into a more intense generation of development, you got to figure out how to get rid of the old stuff.
And here we're setting the stage up front, anticipating that that will be part of the normal evolution, whereas others, the normal evolution was we're building started out with a livery stable, then went to something else, then went to something else, and 100 years later, we end up with an office building. Here, we can start out saying, yeah, we're going to have, Councilmember Summers and I have always talked about this garage. We know that we start with a garage, but eventually we're going to evolve so we can set the stage now, set the parameters, and set the framework, and even the process for having that evolution without having to have fights along the way. We understand from day one that's how we're planning for it to evolve.
The goal here, it's interesting, Mayor. We talk about the historically the way cities evolved from the livery stable and that kind of evolution. One of the things that happened that a lot of people will make the case we did wrong in American city planning is that when we shifted into a suburban planning model, we made it even harder for those transitions to take place.
Because we started compartmentalizing.
Because we did Euclidean zoning that compartmentalized and separated everything. Because we put CC&Rs on it that said nothing will ever change. Because we made it more difficult to reassemble properties. And because we spread intensity out, it didn't evolve over time as easily. So we're trying now to go back and recapture, in a planning context, a way of letting everyone know this is going to evolve. This is going to change. You got to expect it from the outset.
I think Councilmember Summers has a question.
I told the mayor I want to get in on this conversation because I think we've all had the opportunities to bounce it back and forth. But it's important how this development over time occurs and how you are trying to plan for it here. And that number of 20 million square feet, that aspiration. And what we had discussed is I want us to be able to get there without what we think of as the traditional urban redevelopment program. That is, we try to reassemble land, we have to try to knock over buildings to do it, to get that 20 million square feet, because we're just really bad at it. And it just isn't the right thing to do, especially when it's done wrong and government gets involved, because typically it takes a lot of money, or a lot more money, government action, and that's not the direction we want to go. There's a picture in our books. Could somebody throw this up on Elmo? I tell you what, let's take a look at this, that I particularly like. And how do we plan for this growth to get to 20, just to 20 million square feet, that aspirational goal? How do we get that 20 million square feet without having to knock over the Liberty Stable? And one way you do that is how you're looking to plan the development of the land over time. We're just not working with this, are we? In that conversation, I think you have a specific example that DMB has been involved with, where it may start out with a little bit lower intensity. There it is.
There are several examples of this around town. The one that is the most current, and you can go see it happening today if you want, is Kierland, Kierland, when it started out with a short retail strip right off of Scottsdale Road where Crate and Barrel is and Restoration Hardware and a couple of uses. And then it eventually extended back to where the restaurants and the park are. But one whole side of that was just a surface parking lot. Then subsequently came in and built additional retail with, on top of that, condos and other uses and a parking garage behind it. So that was a entirely privately driven model of doing what we're talking about here in what's shown on the Elmo machine. What we're doing here is to go one step farther than that. This is really smart, good developers do this internally. They think about how can our development transition and change over time. Westcor's done this with a lot of their malls. You know, you start out with entirely surface parked, Scottsdale Fashion Square even, you remember when it was all surface parked, and then over time you build intensity and you start shifting into structured parking. What we're doing here, and this is really presaging what we're going to be talking about in the PCD context, is not only are we internally thinking about that issue, but we're actually going to file plans with the city showing what we're calling site plan development potential. So that as individual sites come in for approval in their initial phase of development, we're going to file a plan showing you how it might transition in the future. I am unaware of anyone who's ever done this previously. I am convinced we're going to get this written up in national magazines. You know, this is exciting for planners and zoning lawyers. You get a national magazine, you've accomplished something. Because I think it isn't a framework that cities have been involved in the past. We've tended to operate our zoning systems based on a static decision at a point in time, and then sometime in the future, we'll have a battle royal about changing anything. And we're trying to move away from that, and by using the site plan development potential, to not only let the city council and the city staff know, but to let people in the area know this is going to change over time. It's going to become more intense. It's going to develop.
And it's up on the Elmo right now. Looks like folks can see it from home. This is a type of smart development that allows us to utilize the market. We can do the first picture there, that two-story office, perhaps now. But over time, and without replacing the two-story office, increase the floor to area ratio, increase the number of jobs, get that urban density, have the parking and that urban feel. Without having to knock over the proverbial garage, we can reach that 20 million square feet through good planning such as this. And that's what I want to make sure that we move toward in this plan, that we can hit the assumptions without having to knock something over to do it.
And now you just heard Grady's example of why that will happen from a planning perspective. Let me just give you a little sense of what that means from an economist's perspective. To create density, you have to create some place where people will accept density. And how do you do that? You create amenities that people want to have. They want to be able to walk down the block to a restaurant. They want to be able to walk down the block to a desirable a retail establishment. They want to have convenience in exchange for that density. And so the key here really is you need a catalyst to make all of that happen. In the case of this project, the catalyst is, in fact, the hospitality component you guys have been talking about. These are very briefly the numbers from the hospitality component. You can see construction impacts, 7,000 job years. But on an operational basis, it's 4,000 to 5,000 continuing jobs from hospitality. What does that mean? Think about that. That means hotel rooms, high-end hotel rooms, restaurants that support hotels, conveniences that support hotels. Quite frankly, I think we all go to the restaurants in the summertime that we're glad that the snowbirds from the wintertime subsidize well, and then we're always happy when they leave.
And I think it's important because as we've gone through the Gaylord thing, a part of the debate and the public discourse has been somehow thinking that that Gaylord, which is the first gigantic piece of this puzzle, is somehow the ends. And how I've always looked at it, and I think what we're hearing here, is that really it's a means, very important means, to a much greater ends. And that it truly is does serve as not only in and of itself a significant impact, but the more important thing is that it is a gigantic catalyst, which drives many other types of development and growth and the type of quality that makes these other things not only possible but lays the foundation for those.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We were I was talking with a couple people in the hallway before we started this about the proposed redevelopment that's taking place at the Arizona Biltmore Hotel. If you think about it, and the reason 24th and Camelback emerged as an attractive location really has a lot to do with the Biltmore Hotel is at one end, Sky Harbor is down at the other end of 24th Street. Camelback Road goes from downtown Phoenix to downtown Scottsdale. So you had this crossroads sitting there, but nobody would have gone there but for the Biltmore Hotel bringing people into that site.
Which, when it was built, was literally in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly. It was at the end of a dirt road in unincorporated Maricopa County, you know, in 1926 or 27 when it was built.
So that, that catalyst impact from an economist's perspective is what makes all of this happen. So I think that's part of your answer is what comfort can you have that this will occur? Well, you've already started knocking over, if you will, the first domino that will begin to knock over other things that will happen after that. And with that, quite frankly, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. Oh, Councilmember Summers? More?
You should have known.
I didn't even look here.
I had this presentation the other day, in all fairness, it went over 2 hours, I think, and everybody missed a meeting.
And all your questions weren't answered?
And no, that's that is why this is going to be so much shorter.
Oh, okay.
I have one question on two questions. First question is on the major assumptions, the economic assumptions in the model. You said that we're looking at, the assumption was 14.5 million office, 1.2 retail, and 4,000 hotel rooms. You add that up, it's about 20 million square feet. You also noted that Phoenix had 11.9 million square feet develop over 100 years, Scottsdale Air Park at 9.8 million in 15 years. How do you come to, how did you get to the assumption that this space could actually do 14.5 million of office over the course of the next 40 years? Looks like Scottsdale Air Park, if they were to continue to grow, could hit that. Phoenix was a lot slower. So how did that, how realistic is that model, and how did you get to make that assumption as being a realistic assumption?
Yeah, I might just start. It's an aggressive assumption. There's no question about that. And a lot of it goes back to those early economic forums we did when you remember we brought Gotti Kaufman from Robert Charles Lesser in to talk about kind of the model, the Century City model, the amount of office development that's occurred around John Wayne Airport. This is a more aggressive and in that sense more optimistic development expectation than anybody in metropolitan Phoenix has ever done. And I want to be upfront about that. I mean, we're proud of that, but it's stretching things. If you think about that downtown Phoenix, for example, 11.5 million, half of that is government. More than half of that is probably government space. We're not assuming that any of this is government space. So the Scottsdale Air Park model is, I think, a good one. But if you think about what happened at Scottsdale Air Park, there were a couple of things there that we're much better off here. One is you got a lot bigger airport than Scottsdale Air Park did. I mean, Scottsdale Air Park cannot really accommodate commercial travel. They've flirted with it from time to time, but it's a huge problem. You think you have overflight and noise issues, it's much trickier up there in terms of jets coming in. Two is, it doesn't have nearly as good a transportation network as this location is going to have. It is remarkable how, for once, in metropolitan Phoenix, we're sort of ahead of the curve with freeway construction out in the area.
Scottsdale Air Park, the tipping point was really the completion of the 101.
At the 101, that's exactly right. That's what
that
finally
really
made
up
it
the
happen.
North part,
right. And that's one freeway. You know, we've got two here already and a third on its way before long. The third thing is there's no university at Scottsdale Air Park. And that, I think, can have some significant potential. And the fourth thing is you have extremely fractured ownership up there. It's all kinds of split up ownership, small parcels, Indian reservation land, all kinds of things. Here we've got, in DMB's case, one major owner focused on making this happen. So when we began this whole process, frankly, the 20 million square foot number was driven by our planning process. We gave it to the economists. They didn't come up and say that we think you could do this. They analyzed what it would happen if we did. We came up and said we think we can do it based on the John Casartis, Aerotropolis stuff, the Gotti Kaufman stuff, the Ioannis Morfessas stuff, the early planning models we did about how exciting we think this area can become.
And I want to keep things in perspective or in context, though, because, yeah, it's pretty aggressive. The fact of the matter is that in your bottom line thing, that's still pretty impressive. If we could actually meet the bottom line, that is on par with many of the other very successful areas. I don't think, certainly from a job creation standpoint, I don't think anyone would count Scottsdale Air Park as a failure.
Right.
And what we're saying is that even on your most conservative types of things, we still look at, because of the advantages that we have, we still look at this as being a potentially very successful area with an upside that is tremendous because of the factors we're talking about. I think we might have a tendency to think of it as purely pie in the sky unless we put it into context of why we think this has more potential. And you mentioned about five of those reasons, right?
If I may, let me say one other thing about these two numbers. You'll notice one of the differences here is the aggressive scenario, the 20 million square foot and 15,000 dwelling units, the less aggressive, the 8.6 million square foot and 10,000 dwelling units. You notice the change in the dwelling units. The reason for that is that 5,000 unit delta between the 10 and the 15 are the higher density units. In either scenario, there's about 10,000 houses. That, by the way, is what was in your existing general plan, was about 10,000 houses. The thing that we think the potential exists here for, and this is another reason why we think that the higher numbers may be achievable, is that the nature of the way we live in America is starting to change. Now, we've got a big blip in that with what's happening in the economy right now. But all the trends prior to things slowing down were that people are beginning to look for more urban dwelling units, higher density dwelling units, that the baby boomers do not want to retire the way their parents did, that they're looking for this greater mix of intensity and sort of urban vitality and excitement. Those two things then go sort of hand in hand. The higher number of commercial and office jobs with the higher density residential units. And that's why when we started this whole process of dialoguing with the city, it was about, let's do this in an urban core instead of in a job area and a housing area. Let's try to get more mixed use. That's a critical component to achieving the higher potential of the site. And another reason we think
none of the other areas you've talked about
did that. Exactly right.
I mean, Tempe is just now, Tempe in a smaller way because of its existing neighborhoods, and now it's bringing people back to the core. Phoenix is trying to bring people back to the core, and there really is no core in Scottsdale Air Park. It's primarily a job area. So this is unique from that standpoint, that we're creating that mix from day one, whereas the others have tried to evolve. Councilmember Higgins? And
then Mayor, the question regarding the commercial floor space, we know, non-residential. If we build to like the minimums that are currently in your suggested report, will we get there, or are you targeting like mid-range for all your little densities, like we'll say like certain area where you say office building 0 to 7 floors? So when you come up with that big number, are you targeting the middle of all those different zoning categories that you've created, or you know, will we get there if it's just minimum, or do we have to be at the maximum?
Yeah, I don't know, Trevor, what is the max? It isn't 20 million, it's 30 some.
When we add up all of our columns, we're in 30 million categories.
Right.
To give you an idea, 5 million square feet on 100 acres would be an FAR of 1, basically. And so we have enough land to do incredible things within the limits of the development agreement, way beyond the 20 million even, other than once you saw those numbers about Scottsdale Air Park and other places, to talk about numbers beyond 20 million really seemed outrageous.
Yeah.
And when we talk about infrastructure, truly.
The 20 million is aggressive, but in the community plan, we could go significantly higher than that. I think it's more than 30.
And I think we could dibble around with a lot of the numbers and everything. Councilmember, some for all day if we wanted to. Councilmember Summers has another thing, and then we'll want to move on, because we've got other things we've got to talk about in this.
I could go on all day, and I know where Councilmember Higgins is going, so I'm going to try this and see if we can chew on this before we finalize the whole plan. The idea here is that we want to maximize the job resident ratio, try to aim for that 20,000 square foot, 50,000 or 47,000 employees. A lot of that is written out in the general plan that has already been approved just recently. Quite a fact, there's quite a lot of it. But we have an interesting zoning code here that talks, it's unique, and it talks about so many different elements from archaeology and airport sensitivity, geology and soils. It's a little different zoning code than we've ever had before, partially because it's form-based. But there's really no discussion in here, even though we get a lot of input from everybody else, about the economic development part and how these sites are going to come forward. So, for example, what I would recommend, since it does say provide some directions, we have a discussion where you go back to staff and have a discussion about, in Section 3, it's the overall vision. Vision statement, 21st century urbanism, that we include a vision about how this is a key employment center, how the job's going to provide out somewhere between that 8.5 million, which isn't a real number, and the 20 million. So let's just talk about how might we get to that 20 million jobs and have that vision statement in there. In Section 4, we might add something on, we have a lot of planning in here, so we could add a section on economic development that outlines the plan to work towards that job strategy. And probably even a little bit more important, in Section 5, there's, and I read through 5.1, we have land use submittals, guidelines, engineering plan. We should probably include, as folks come forward with their site plans or the DUPs, include a DUP submittal on how the plan meets the economic development goals outlined in that strategy in Sections 3 and 4 that we're going to add, but also how it meets the general plan amendment. And then at some point have a discussion on how we might measure those goals so that when economic development reviews it, that they have something substantive to look at. And I cut that short.
Well, and you were concise. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I don't know that there was anything really new that we haven't discussed about it. It's just a matter of bringing what we've been discussing into the document.
And
creating something like that.
It's taking what we had discussed.
Okay.
Codifying.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think we can come up with a way to do that.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Are you staying up there for the next part?
Or
is that maybe? Okay.
Well, we might see.
Oh, okay.
If we have some questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Al.
Thanks, Scott. Alan.
Thank you. We'll move on to the next item, which is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed plan community development or district. I mean,
Mayor Council. I'll start off, and we'll kind of see where it goes from there. But we don't have a specific presentation at this point. We are moving towards the October 6th introduction of the ordinance and the community plan. At the time that we introduce that, whatever gets introduced on the 6th is what you'll be considering then on the 20th of October for approval. So staff's been working with the applicant to continue to make adjustments to this document. So hopefully next week we can give you a revised document with all the red lines, with all the things we've agreed to. So at your study session a week from today, you'll have that. We can discuss it and make sure we've addressed all your concerns. So what we're looking for now is kind of recap some of those things we've talked about. We've given you some things back already. Are we moving in the right direction? Are there other things we need to be working on to include in this document, like we just talked about with employment, that we should be working on to have back to you next week? So in particular, we've talked about sustainability, and we've talked about some of the transit transportation issues. We passed out to you, all these meetings are starting to run together, I believe on Monday, the some revised language having to do with sustainability. And so we could start there. Have we addressed that sufficiently yet? Is there still something more you're wanting to see? Do you need some more explanation from DMB about how they are dealing with sustainability? I believe they're handling that question already. So that's one question. Again, on the transit, we've put some things in there already. Has that been sufficient? Is there more that you would like to see? And then beyond that, are there other issues that you would like to get more information on that you think we need to be addressing and included in the plan document? So that's kind of where we're at this morning.
Okay. When do we anticipate, are we going to get this piecemeal? We are getting it piecemeal, I know. Are we going to get at one point in time saying that red line document that here's what we have so we can all sort of put it together? Because
you know, it's I guess it's easier for you, since you're living this day in and day out, to understand how these things flow and fit together. I one of the challenges I have is as we get a section here and then a section there and a section there, is trying to remember
right
how they all fit together and put them into into context.
Right. Mayor, again, last Friday we sent you a new base document.
Right.
Based on all the approvals as they came out of the Planning and Zoning Board. What we want to give you next Tuesday with your packet is that document with any red lines, or red lines that have occurred since then. So you only really have one other document you have to look at that's captured any modifications okay from the P&Z document.
Okay. And that, we're assuming that would have all the substantive items that we will be acting on in the introduction of the ordinance.
Correct.
Understanding that once we introduce the ordinance, this is not changing.
Correct.
At least until we go through a formal type of amendment.
Right, without coming back to reintroduce.
This is the one we will be voting on.
Right.
Okay.
Mayor and Council, yes. Just also, there's a lot of moving pieces here, and John's speaking specifically to the zoning document you talked about. We're still also working on the development agreement, which we're going to talk about in the executive session. So even though we feel like we may have a good handle on this issue, there are still a lot of loose ends left to be discussed on the development agreement. But that won't come until the October 20th meeting. So, but we would like to have everything settled up so that we can provide you the most up-to-date document on the 2nd. I think I'm saying that right, or the
study session on the 2nd.
So that it will be, you'll have that on the 2nd. You'll then have an opportunity on your Thursday council meeting to look at that before the October 6th introduction. So it gives you Tuesday, we'll get it in your packet, Thursday, the 4th, I think I'm saying, 2nd? 2nd, I'm sorry, 2nd. So we're just trying to get that out ahead of time. So next Tuesday, you should have everything we're going to stop, I guess, the modifications at that point. We'll take what we have, present that to you on the 2nd. That will be what you'll be able to comment in on Thursday. And then with the following Monday is when we'll be bringing that to council for introduction, assuming it's ready to go for introduction on the 6th. But then in the meantime, we are still working on the development agreement that is related to the same zoning, and that's what we'll be talking about here in a few minutes.
Okay. Are there any specific questions? All righty. Thank you. We will now move from the... Oh, let's do that. Hear reports on meetings and or conferences attended from the council. Any reports? Yeah, we'll do the Target deal. Okay. We'll do the Target deal. Most of us on the council had the opportunity last Tuesday, wasn't it? Tuesday night to attend the rollout of the 3 for Free program, which is being underwritten by Target Corporation and sponsored by the Arizona Republic, which enables members of our community to visit the 3 primary attractions we have in the downtown area, the 2 museums and the art galleries at the Mesa Arts Center, for free every first Sunday. So this was a great event, and it's a great program, and we really appreciate the investment in our community by Target and the Republic and the ongoing support of our quality of life activities. So we had the opportunity to be there, so that was good. Councilmember Richens.
Last week I had the opportunity to attend the Montana Smart Growth Coalition Conference in Helena, Montana, and also meet with some other smart growth groups statewide to better understand. It really talks about a lot of the principles that DMB is incorporating in their plan here and how it relates to growing smarter and more efficiently and building better quality. So it was really a neat conference to attend.
Good. Mr. Brady, oh.
I'll just throw it
down. Okay, Vice Mayor.
This last week we had a visit from a city manager from one of our sister cities, from Upper Hutt, New Zealand, Mr. Patterson. Had the opportunity to go out to dinner with him and discuss a few items, and he gave me one of their city council ties, which has their coat of arms on it.
And I understand they wear that. All the council members wear that.
Wear their tie.
It's an official part of their dress for their meetings.
So
we're going to go to bow ties.
Yeah, maybe not.
Johan's going to help us with
that. Yeah, Johan, Mr. Zietzman will help us with that. Councilmember Higgins.
I just wanted to tell Charlotte McDermott and I had a thorough tour of the new ASU Poly buildings, and extremely impressive. If you haven't gotten out there, it becomes a whole new campus where it's all brand new and it's very exciting. The landscaping's awesome, and it's a great thing. Tell your friends to go visit. So if their kids are getting close to college, it's a really neat university setting now.
Great. Mr. Brady, meetings, schedules.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder to the council, tonight we have our joint Mesa Public School City Council meeting. That'll be at 5:30 p.m. At the La Veranda, which you're familiar with, at the Dobson Ranch Golf Course. And then this Saturday, the 27th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. is the National Emergency Preparedness Event. It will be held at the Mesa Riverview Bass Pro Shop. So we invite you out for those ceremonies. And then we'll be having another study session again, as we mentioned, on Thursday, October 2nd, which will be followed by an audit and finance committee meeting that morning. And then later that afternoon, or a little bit later in the day, there will be a public safety committee meeting at 1:30 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a request to speak from one citizen, Mr. Kenneth Solfrank. Please come on up. Mr. Solfrank, you have 3 minutes.
Okay. So right here?
Just have a seat right there.
Okay. My name is Kenneth Solfrank. Thank you for seeing me. I actually live in Riverside, California, in a city called Temecula. I was driving through your fair city on the 10th, and I got pulled over by an officer, and my vehicle was impounded. I had current driver's license, valid insurance, and valid registration. Yet he ran me and said that when I lived here 15 years ago that I had a suspended driver's license and that gave him the right to impound my vehicle, which he did. I went that very day to the Downtown Justice Center to clarify and clear up why my license was suspended, and they had informed me that I had in fact paid that ticket back in 94 before I moved back to California. I have the copy of the paid receipt from the court downtown and from the DMV. And when I went to the back to the Mesa PD, Joseph Bonacci said that he doesn't even want to see that the ticket had been paid or anything, and for 30 days, because he has the right to hold my vehicle for 30 days. And according to the judge downtown, this should never have happened because the ticket had been taken care of 15 years ago. And but he refuses to even see this, and I've already lost my job over this. And I don't make a whole lot of money doing what I do, but I've come back and forth on the Greyhound, and I was just hoping I could get some help from somebody here, because I provided everything that they needed. I'm valid license, insurance, registration, everything, and I just can't lose anymore. I don't know what else to do. I didn't know where else to turn, so I was hoping I could maybe get an ear here from somebody.
Well, you've got an ear, and Mr. Brady will have staff be with you and help you work through this. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, we will now reconvene into executive session.